Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. In the course of the 40 or so years that I've been working on various aspects of national security policy, one of the men I've come to admire most and worked closely with over very, very many of those years is our guest for a full and very special hour-long conversation about the state of the American national security enterprise and the various challenges to it. He is a man who has, through a variety of different experiences, many of them in senior ranks of the United States government, both in uniform and in the civil side, had the ability to actually practice national security policy, not simply comment on it. He is doing a lot of that of late, notably through a wonderful organization he now chairs called the High Frontier. But in his previous incarnations, among other things, our guest, Dr. Henry Cooper, was an Air Force officer. He was a civilian in the Department of the Air Force. He was the assistant director of the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, as well as a deputy assistant secretary of the Air Force. He served as the director of the Strategic Defense Initiative under President George Herbert Walker Bush, and has been a soulmate an extraordinary colleague, notably, but not exclusively, in one of his functions which earned him the rank of ambassador, that of President Reagan's chief negotiator at the Geneva Defense and Space Talks. Man, in short, of great capability, tremendous experience, and a real record of service to our country, a man I'm very proud to call a friend. Hank Cooper, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio.
Thanks, Frank. I'm really pleased to join you, and thank you for that generous introduction. It's been great to work with you for 40 years, going on 40 years.
I think that's about right, but who's counting? Listen, Hank, you just recently contributed, together with several others of our colleagues, notably Jim Woolsey and Dr. Peter Pry and Fritz Ehrmarth, Bill Graham, Dr. William Graham, former president, presidential science advisor under Ronald Reagan, to a really important piece that appeared in Roll Call newspaper, one of the newspapers that services Capitol Hill. I want you to talk with our audience about the thesis of this piece and how it bears perhaps very, very dramatically on the what I call Obama bomb deal that has more or less gotten through unscathed on Capitol Hill.
Yeah, that's an astounding outcome, frankly. Iran has been working toward nuclear weapons for 65 years. This was one of the things we pointed out in our paper, which basically comes to the bottom line that policymakers really ought to presume that Iran already has nuclear weapons. This deal is supposed to, in return for removing the sanctions, $100 billion, beginning, I guess, whenever, I don't know exactly when the detail is, it begins.
I think early next year is when the sanctions would start coming undone.
That's when the audit trail goes, and I think it goes up to at least $150 billion, so on. Some of it will go to outsourcing, no doubt, its ally North Korea, who's already got nuclear weapons and so on. But the premise of our paper is that given that they've been working toward a nuclear weapon for so many years, they've actually been in more or less a crash program for the better part of 25 years. They have been in a lie with North Korea since the 1990s, during which time we went through a round where we presumed you could trust the North Koreans and they wouldn't get the bomb, but of course they have, as well as the ballistic missiles to deliver them. And now this is this deal is supposed to somehow, in exchange for these sanctions, kick the can down the road for 10 or so years. And my colleagues and I just say this premise is wrong. I mean, fundamentally, we should be presuming they already have the bomb. And if you think about it from the point of view of how long it takes to build a bomb, of course, we had a massive program in the 1940s called the Manhattan Project. We built two atomic weapons, the first two atomic weapons in existence. So the first one we used on Hiroshima to bomb Hiroshima, it had never been tested, and that's another assumption that people have, is that if you don't test it, you really can't count on its use. Well, our very first nuclear weapon, atomic weapon, we call it in those days, was never tested before it was used. And the second one was a plutonium bomb, a different design, and it was used on Nagasaki. It was, in fact, tested at Trinity because it involved an implosion design that there were questions about whether or not it would work appropriately, but it did, first time, and we used it very shortly thereafter to bomb Hiroshima, to bomb Nagasaki. So it took us 3 years. The United Kingdom took a dozen years. They were slowed up by politics and a bad economy and so on.
And by the way, Hank, let me just interrupt you for a second to say something about the 3 years. The 3 years, of course, were the course of the Manhattan Project during World War II. We were inventing the entire science of nuclear weaponry, in that case, atomic weaponry, and doing it with things that you used to use, I'm sure, slide rules, and the most primitive of calculators, not computers, not all of the technology, let alone know-how, that's available today to countries with cash like Iran.
Well, that's right. And Johnny von Neumann, who was one of the early designers of computers, was a part of the Manhattan Project. They did have analog computers, and they built some of the first digital computers not long thereafter, if not already as a part of the process. But yes, that's right. All of that was done with what we would consider to be rudimentary science today. And it was done by some extraordinary scientists and engineers, not to be argumentative about the case, but there were people who were concerned about the Germans getting the bomb before us, and a lot of our best scientists and engineers went to Los Alamos to work on that project.
No, I don't mean to deprecate any of them. I just mean to say it's all the more extraordinary when you think that in just 3 years they accomplished this feat of engineering and science with fairly rudimentary capabilities, as you say. Hank, but I interrupted you. You were talking about some of the other nations that have also made this transition from a nuclear wannabe to nuclear weapon states. What's the maximum length that's taken anybody to do it?
Well, South Africa took 10 to 12 years, however you might look at it. And I said the United Kingdom took 12, but that was politics and a bad economy. France was like 4 years, China 9 years, India 5 years, Pakistan, worked on it for 12 years or so, and they had developed the designs for the weapons earlier, actually, than the 12-year time period in which they actually tested. So North Korea tested first in 2006, we pointed out, and they had missiles earlier than that. And of course, we went through this yin-yang during the Clinton administration of how we were going to block them from getting nuclear weapons. But in 8 to 10 years, they had them, and they had the nuclear weapons to put on board. And now we're, wringing our hands about an upcoming test with North Korea. This couples back to Iran, frankly, because Iran has been present at the testing activities of North Korea. They are an ally.
And Hank, we're going to have to pause here for just a second, but I just wanted to emphasize the point that you and your colleagues made, that if this deal, which for reasons we'll talk about in a moment, was so horribly defective in so many respects, even if you believe that it was just the price that we were paying to get some kind of stay of execution, I guess is the way I would put it, a deferral of the Iranian nuclear project, But all that's over the side because they already have the bomb. Then what we're giving them, whatever the amount of money is, whatever the other concessions are being made, the jihadists that we're giving a sort of get out of jail free card to, this just makes this an absolute travesty and a betrayal of our country, it seems to me. We'll talk more about that and a great deal more with our guest, Ambassador Henry Cooper, the chairman of High Frontier, right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
If you listen to this radio station a lot, you may have noticed our brand new name. It's got a catchy ring to it. But there's more than that. The name actually tells you who we are and what we do in one word. It took us a while to come up with this, but we realized if there's one thing we want to be to DC listeners, it was this. We want to be your answer to everything, to what happened while you slept, to why am I stuck in traffic, to how do you get control of this country again. Big stuff and little stuff. This may be a tall order for one radio station, but we know we're up for it. AM 1260, The Answer.
Great news for fans of Secure Freedom Radio. Now you can watch original Frank Gaffney and Center for Security Policy video content every day from the comfort of your living room. What makes this possible? A new video streaming service called Roku. All you need is a Roku player and a television to join the millions of Americans who customize their home viewing experience using the more than 1,000 Roku channels to access movies, TV shows, music, and more. When you add the cost-free Secure Freedom Roku channel, you'll gain unlimited streaming access to vital video products of the center, including Secure Freedom Radio, Capitol Hill and National Press Club events, intelligence briefings, Frank Gaffney's acclaimed 10-part Muslim Brotherhood in America course, and more. The Secure Freedom Roku channel integrates information and entertainment, establishing a new media battle space in the war for the free world. Go to securefreedom.org/ROKU today to learn how you can be a part of it. We hope you'll see us soon.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. Ambassador Henry Cooper is our guest, a man who knows a lot about national security in general and particularly about arms control, having served in one of the senior positions in the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency, a bureaucracy that happily, from my point of view, no longer exists, but at the time was very much at work in the Reagan administration. And Hank, I just wonder, as a guy who has a background, among other things, in this arms control business, what do you make of claims that have been offered up about the perfect knowledge that we have of the Iranian nuclear history, and in particular, the comprehensive, unprecedented, intrusive verification associated with this Obama bomb deal?
Well, that's laughable, Frank. I mean, the fact of the matter is we are not involved in whatever inspections go on because we're not a member of the IAEA. That's the International Atomic Energy Agency.
We're a member of it. We're just not party to any of these inspection teams.
We have, of course, worked with we're a member of the United Nations, but the IAEA is the body that is supposed to be doing the alleged inspections. But in fact, those are not really intrusive in the sense that we've normally think of it from the Reagan years, where Reagan said trust but verify. And frankly, I was surprised that we were able to get the Soviets to buy into the intrusive measures that we got. Of course, that had to do with Reagan's insistence on these kinds of measures as a part of the deals that he was working with Gorbachev and at the most senior levels. But they eventually did agree to very intrusive inspection regime, which we walked away from, by the way, in the New START treaty during the Obama administration. And this deal that we have with Iran, the IAEA is the inspecting body, but they, you know, in one of the most outrageous arrangements, you know, are going to rely on self-inspection by the Iranians themselves on some of the key sites of concern.
Hank Cooper is visiting with us about defects in this deal with Iran. And Hank, I think there's no question about it that allowing the Iranians effectively to self-inspect is a formula for disaster. But as you look at this this agreement, and you have a background in sort of the nuclear weapons business, when you hear people like the Secretary of Energy, Ernest Moniz, or the president, for that matter, assert that we have closed off all of the pathways to a nuclear weapon for Iran. What do you make of that representation?
Well, I think it's absurd, frankly. And the fellow that really surprised me most was Colin Powell, who was Ronald Reagan's national security advisor during some of these talks, and of course became chairman of the Joint Chiefs. And he was fooled, as you recall, by the events of Iraq. First of all, that they we all were fooled, frankly, after the Gulf War when we found that they were within months, actually, of having nuclear weapons capability in Iraq. That Saddam Hussein was actually that close. And not only our intelligence community was fooled, but the Mossad, the Israeli intelligence community, was fooled. So we were wrong then when we thought that they didn't have a bomb. And then a few years later, when Cullen became Secretary of State during the Bush administration, the intelligence community absolutely confirmed to him that they had. They were very close to having a nuclear weapons. They have had worrisome contacts for it. George Tenet, who was the director of Central Intelligence, called it a slam dunk. And so Cullen went before the United Nations and made his case, got the UN behind it, behind the attack to go into Iraq during the George W. Bush administration, as well as the Congress that went along with us. And lo and behold, when we got there, we found that Saddam Hussein was boasting that he had that capability, but he in fact did not have it. So Cullen had been fooled, firsthand fooled, two times with Iraq, with folks in the meat, but twice. And then he came out and said this deal was effectively verifiable. He said that instead of the trust but verify, we should take the position you don't trust, but you verify, and I forget, verify again, you know. And so, you know, he mouthed the right words there, but as if he didn't learn. It's just absurd. It really is laughable.
Hank Cooper, let me ask you, one of the things that you have really been a leader nationally on for many years in terms of challenges our country is facing, but it's particularly relevant, it seems to me, in connection with this very defective deal with Iran and the likelihood that Iran will have nuclear weapons in short order if, in fact, as you've suggested in roll call, they don't already. And that is the possibility that the Iranians, conceivably with even a single nuclear weapon used in a particular fashion, could take down this country. Talk a little bit about how that might work and how realistic a threat you believe that to be.
Well, Frank, Iran has, as you know, launched satellites to the south. People are worried right now that North Korea is going to be launching a satellite to the south. They said they were. There's a bunch of back and forth with North Korea. I bet when they do, Iran will be present at that launch. They have been participants before. And when I say to the south, both of these satellites come over the United States. Of course, they transit an orbit in about an hour and a half. And so they come over many times a day. And so on the first orbit, when it comes over the polar regions and approaches the United States from the south, we don't even today believe we don't have the warning systems. Well, we have a warning system, but we aren't able to track satellites sufficient to shoot them down, even if we were prepared to shoot them down. So if you put a nuclear weapon, either from North Korea or from Iran, on one of these satellites coming over the south polar regions, you could set it off 100 or so miles above the United States, and that would produce an electromagnetic pulse that could shut down the entire electric grid of this country. And as you know, if you lose electricity in this country for an extended period of time, which would be the consequence I'm talking about, then you have a situation where you lose electricity and everything that we depend on, everything from benign kinds of things like, you know, banking and medicine and things like that.
Food,
all
water,
the way to water,
yeah,
and food, yeah, et cetera. And we could lose most Americans within a year's time.
Let me just ask you, because even without the satellite option, there's been concern for quite some time. As you know, one of your several of your co-authors, in fact, Jim Woolsey and Peter Pry and Bill Graham especially, have been warning about the so-called Scud in a tub scenario. You know a lot about ballistic missiles, and we'll be talking more about that soon. But firing a relatively short range off of a ship brought close to our shores is another way of affecting that kind of electromagnetic pulse attack. Is that credible in your judgment?
That was the scenario that the EMP Commission worried about, a ship off of our coast. And the one I worry about is a vessel in the Gulf of Mexico, because we have absolutely no defense against the launch of the type you described from there.
Well, this is, again, a subject we're going to turn to now in just a moment after our break, Hank Cooper, because, as I say, you've devoted a fair amount of your life to trying to protect this country, either through deterrence or through active missile defense against ballistic missiles, and how it could possibly be that we don't have the ability to prevent an attack of this kind, a relatively easy kind of attack. Doesn't require an accurate missile. It doesn't require a sophisticated nuclear weapon. But especially if you're right that Iran may already have the bomb, this is something we better be about. And we'll talk more with Hank Cooper about how to do it and practical steps that all of us could get behind right now for the purposes of protecting our grid and our country against electromagnetic pulse and other threats. That and more with Hank Cooper right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. One of the places where jihad, the effort to achieve our submission to the Islamic supremacist doctrine of Sharia, is playing out in America is in our courts. A study by the Center for Security Policy earlier this year identified nearly 150 instances across the country in which they were asked to rule on disputes by referring to this barbaric, repressive legal code instead of our own. It's a judicial practice called comity. Such cases have caused 10 states so far to adopt legislation requiring that only American laws be used in our courts, where doing otherwise would infringe on constitutional rights. Meanwhile, with the encouragement of the U.S. government, our courts are also being used to protect governments like Iran and Saudi Arabia from the penalties arising from lawsuits by victims of their terrorism. That's called outrageous. This is Frank Gaffney. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. Our guest is Ambassador Henry Cooper. He served, among other things, as the president's director of the Strategic Defense Initiative Organization under the George Herbert Walker Bush administration. As I mentioned, he has been involved deeply personally and at the highest levels in trying to protect our country against various threats, particularly nuclear ones. And so, Hank, I wanted just to double back. I think you had a point of clarification you wanted to make about this satellite possibility as a delivery system for the North Koreans or the Iranians.
Thanks, Frank. Before I turn to your question, though, on the missile defense side, I want to say a word or two more about the threat of the satellites. If you put a warhead on a satellite, you don't have to design it to take any particular concern of the fact that you have to re-enter the Earth's atmosphere or deal with that sort of thing that a payload on a rocket might have to do. And so the design constraints on the nuclear weapon are somewhat relieved. And I already mentioned to you that our very first nuclear weapon, which you wouldn't deliver this way, of course, delivered by a bomber, had never been tested. These designs, though, today are well known. You don't need that heavy a device in order to get the nuclear capability that's required to produce EMP. So I am particularly concerned about the satellite threat. So it doesn't have to be super hard megaton, but that word is actually kiloton-level weapons if they're designed properly to produce a large number of gamma rays, which create the E1 or the shock EMP pulse, can go off tens of kilometers in altitude, and that might be the concern that you would have about the threat that you worried about. That is a rocket, a scud in a tub, if you will, off our coast. It doesn't have to go up high. The one in the satellite, though, doesn't have to come down either. It's above the Earth's atmosphere when you set it off. And so it's in the right place to cover the entire United States. It could be a single weapon, again, to cover the entire U.S. So in any case, neither one of these are we prepared to defend against.
Hank, one of the things that was said in a congressional testimony when this issue of electromagnetic pulse was addressed in the Science and Technology Committee in the House of Representatives a couple of weeks ago was that, well, you know, this is a very low probability danger because jihadists or terrorists, if you will, want carnage. They want blood and gore and things. So something like this that wouldn't have that effect. The blast goes off up in space. Nobody's going to get killed directly by that blast. How would you respond to this sort of, well, dismissal of the danger of an EMP attack?
Well, the Ayatollah, you know, when he threatens the existence of Israel and the United States and their chance of death to America in the background, I can't think of a way that's more catastrophic to us than a nuclear weapon set off above the Earth's atmosphere to basically kill up to 90% of all Americans. That sounds like death to America to me. And I know that they know this can be done. I mean, it's part of their doctrine. You ought to get Trent Franks to talk to you about this. You know, he, at a conference last year, made public a document, an Iranian document, that points out the important role of EMP and that it's part of their doctrine. So we're just foolish to ignore this threat.
In some 20 different places, as I recall, it talks about the utility of this kind of an attack scenario. And needless to say, Hank Cooper, as you know so well, there would be plenty of death and destruction if that were to play itself out. The most horrifying thing about it, in a way, is that it would be painful and slow and just horrific for those hundreds of millions of Americans. It's not all over in a flash, needless to say.
I say one more thing on that front. Bill Fortune, he has a new book out, which is called One Year After, and I've just started it. And the scenario building from is, I believe, because I'm not in enough of it to really say much about it, but I believe it's Iranian and North Korean threats that he claims was the cause of the first. So it's a notional idea, but, you know, Bill is really excellent in thinking through the substance of what it would mean to society, and I would encourage all your listeners to read his book.
Well, and as you've said, Hank Cooper, our enemies know about our vulnerability. They have been acquiring, in some cases already have acquired, in others they may still be in the process of acquiring the capabilities to take down our electric grid. Hank, let me turn to what do we do about this? Because again, you've not been one to wring your hands or sit idly by as you've seen these kinds of threats to our country take place over your decades of service to our country. Give us a flavor of what, particularly looking at your personal familiarity with means of countering missiles that might be used to deliver these threats, we could be doing and aren't, and why not?
Well, I can't answer the why not part because some of the things we could be doing really are relatively inexpensive and they're not a challenge to our technology and we're just not doing them. Everybody, I think, knows by now that we're deploying what's referred to as Aegis Ashore, which is to take the interceptors and the command and control system off of our Aegis BMD cruisers and destroyers and deploy them on the ground. We're doing this in Romania in a site that, if it's not operational now, will be operational by the end of the year. We have a site in Hawaii. We're building a site in Poland, which should be operational by the end of 2018. So we know how to do it. There's no need of developing a system. It's simply, I guess we'd have to fight the environmental impact statements and so on. It's simply deploying it on military bases, for example, around the Gulf of Mexico, and that would enable us to defend against the threat, the scud in the bucket threat that we're referring to there. It could also deploy it around the East Coast. In that case, I believe that our Aegis ships, our cruisers and destroyers that normally in Norfolk and in various places along the coastal area, if the crews are prepared and trained, they could defend that too. In the case of the satellite that comes over the South Pole, if we simply put the radar that we associate with these systems, the Aegis Ashore system, the TIPI-2 radar, so-called, in the Philippines, that would make it possible to shoot down a satellite coming out of North Korea, because we could provide track information to our ABM system in Vandenberg Air Force Base in California. It has the range and the kill capability to shoot a satellite down, but it needs the track information from forward-based sensors. So, again, we know how to do this. We're building the TIPI-2 radar for our deployments around the world. I don't know what we're up to now, something on the order of a dozen, I guess we have, and it's simply employing an agreement with the Philippines to put it there to deal with North Korea. And Iran, I haven't studied the geography well enough there, but I suspect that we now have ships in the vicinity that could provide what we need in the case of Iran. Also, if we could get close enough to where they're launched from, the launch sites of the satellites, the Aegis system and its air defense system actually is capable technically of shooting down a satellite being launched while the rockets are still burning.
In that so-called boost phase.
In the boost phase. But we have to have software changes, and the crews have to be trained to do this, and most importantly, they have to be authorized to do it, because it's a very short period of time you have. So there are things, quick fixes, I refer to them, that can be done. Beyond that, I believe we should be deploying sensors in space that to enable the tracking capability of all of our systems, and eventually I want to see us go back to the ideas of the Reagan years and deploy space-based interceptors, which is the smartest way to do our defenses altogether. Most of the things that people think about take the time to build. The things I'm most concerned about are quick fixes, because I fear that we will confront this threat more rapidly than most people seem to understand.
Hank Cooper is our guest. We're going to talk more about space and what we need to be doing there to protect ourselves, as well as to challenge or defeat those who would deny us access to it and dominion over it. Hank Cooper, former U.S. ambassador to the Defense and Space Talks under President Reagan, also the director of the Strategic Defense Initiative Organization, and now with High Frontier. That and more straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
I lost my healthy 27-year-old son to influenza. Jacob wasn't someone you'd expect to die from the flu. He was strong, a martial arts athlete. After 5 weeks of fighting, Jacob died.
I'm Dr. Bill Schaffner of the National Foundation for Infectious Diseases. Each year, influenza claims the lives of Americans of all ages, including healthy young adults like Jacob. Ask about vaccination the next time you're at your doctor's office or pharmacy. Visit adultvaccination.org.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. Hank Cooper is our guest for an extraordinary and really important conversation about so many parts of our national defense and potential shortcomings in it that most of us are just not attuned to. He, of course, is one of the country's foremost experts on most of them, having served both in government and out in uniform and in the civilian side in a number of capacities that have given him an expertise, insight, and firsthand, hands-on experience in making policy and hardware changes that kept us safe and free for this long. Hank Cooper, one of the things I wanted to just get back to that you were touching on, but in the missile defense context primarily, is what else could we be doing to protect our electric grid against this phenomenon of electromagnetic pulse? And for that matter, cyber threats or direct physical assaults, radio frequency weapons, whatever form the threats might take, are there things that we could do to make our grid more resilient and therefore less of a temptation, perhaps, for people interested in taking us out?
Frank, I really appreciate the opportunity to respond to that. I'm reading a whole bunch of textbooks. I bought $700 worth of EE electrical engineering textbooks recently to try to wipe a bunch of cobwebs away. And let me share with you what I believe is the most sensible approach to dealing with hardening the electric grid, which is, I think, an essential step we must take. And it's hardening with respect to all of the effects you're talking about. The grid is a very complicated system that has grown up over the years. Various small operating companies put together, et cetera, et cetera. And the idea that you're going to fix it quickly is really, really not plausible. So we need a strategy, in my judgment, of how to begin and what to do first and how to build. And I have concluded in my own mind that the nuclear electric power reactors that we have around the country are the key to the first steps. And this is because for two reasons. They're a problem if you lose the grid. They shut down. They're directed, in fact, to shut down. And if you don't have the electricity to restart them, then you have the potential, let's just say, of the Fukushima events at 100 places around the nation, most of which, three-quarters of which, are in the eastern United States, east of Ohio and so on. And so they're a problem on that side. On the other hand, there's lots of power in the uranium and the power, the nuclear elements that are stored in these reactors. If we can figure out, we being engineers, competent engineers, how they can operate through such an event and so become a source for restoring the grid afterwards. And I've got some ideas about how this can be done. I'm working with people at universities here in South Carolina and one of the Duke Energy organizations, system engineering office there, to try to really put some serious thought behind how to do this. But I believe it's plausible, and that's 20% of our electric power in this country, electricity in the country. South Carolina, it's 60%. So those are big numbers.
Just one of the thoughts that I thought you were going to go with this as perhaps yet another reason why you want to start with the nuclear power plants is because you need to make sure that those things, if they do go down, and lose the power needed to cool their ponds in which they've stored spent fuel. Those things don't cook off, creating an environmental catastrophe that would make Fukushima look like a day at the beach. So for all these reasons, I think your leadership and your willingness to work on the engineering pieces of this, as well as the public policy parts of it, is really deeply appreciated.
Well, I believe that's the key. I mean, I like to have a good news part of the story, and I think that is part of the good news. The power is there if our engineers can sort out how to modify what we have. I believe that, I like to say, Hyman Rickover wouldn't have left us in this place. He built our first commercial reactor, and of course is the father of the nuclear Navy. And another thing that's good about working with the reactors, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission is the body that oversees all of this, and they are a much more competent organization, technically, I believe, than the NERC-FERC arrangement.
We've talked about it at considerable length here at Secure Freedom Radio, for sure. Let me go back to the other topic that I did want to talk with you about in this block, and that is the issue of space. As you indicated, one of the very important initiatives that you pursued very nearly to completion during your time as the director of the Strategic Defense Initiative Organization was something called Brilliant Pebbles. Remind us what that was about and its relevance to our situation today and what use we might be able to make of that kind of technology, or at least the approach.
Absolutely. Brilliant Pebbles was the best technology that came out of the first $30 billion of the Strategic Defense Initiative. That was how much was spent during the Reagan and Bush 41 years. And its idea was autonomous small satellites, each of which understood not only its location and what it saw, but where all of its neighbors in the constellation were located. And we had in mind having like 1,000 of these, providing a global defense over the entire United States, as well as for our troops and allies all the way around the world. It was the least expensive in absolute terms of any system that we considered, and obviously the most cost-effective possibility. The problem we ran into was entirely a political problem. People who didn't want, to deploy, quote, weapons in space.
Or didn't want missile defense, period.
Well, that's also true. And, of course, the treaty really constrained how we could do the development work.
The Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty of 1972.
Right. And it is no more. George W. Bush withdrew from that treaty, thankfully, 2002, I believe it was. And so we're free to develop these systems now, and we only have to overcome the political hurdles. There is a time urgency, in my judgment, in doing this, because in spite of the fact that we stopped doing our work, I mean, during the Clinton years, they broke up the teams that knew what they were doing. They just discovered water, I gather, on Mars. People don't remember a program called Clementine, which we space qualified all of the technologies for Brilliant Pebbles and returning to the moon for the first time.
A somewhat covert operation, as I recall, Hank Cooper. It was, despite the strong opposition of many in the U.S. government at the time under Bill Clinton.
Well, it was not just Bill Clinton. In fact, during my watch, I came home from a hearing when Sam Nunn, who was chairing the Armed Services Committee at the time, made it very clear to me he was going to kill the Brilliant Pebbles program. And I called Pete Warden. You may recall Pete.
Now General Warden.
Right. And retired, a former administrator at NASA Ames. And he's out on his own somewhere now. But in any case, called him and Rip Worrell, who ran the Brilliant Pebbles program then. And I said, I want to invent a program that even our arch enemies will support to space qualify all of the technologies that we know are important. And so we scavenged the Brilliant Pebbles program. It was a program called Clementine. And in fact, Carl Sagan and the whole community of people who opposed Brilliant Pebbles signed on to this. It's hard to say. NASA gave the team awards. The Academy of Sciences gave the team awards when we went back to the moon and discovered for the first time in 25 years and discovered water in the polar regions. So, and then we tried to have a follow-on mission that the community supported, and Bill Clinton's chief guy, on Bob Bell, you may remember, he's now our ambassador to NATO, I believe, told people that we had to, that Clinton would use his line item veto to kill it because it exploited Star Wars technology.
Hank Cooper, we have to pause for just a moment, but it's a real insight into how intrepid, creative, courageous people like you managed to get great things done for our country. We rue the fact that you're not in government at the moment, because we certainly need you there. But we're grateful for you being here with us at Secure Freedom Radio. We'll talk more about what's up next right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
People from around the country have no clue what we're like here in Washington, D.C. Yeah, we've got our whack jobs like the guy who climbed the fence and walked around the White House. We have the people who see the black helicopters. But there's one common denominator for all of us, friends and family. And there's no place where a relationship means more than it does right here. Yeah, we may be famous for the dignitaries, but friends and family, that makes us tick. And frankly, this radio station gets that. That's why I listen. AM 1260, The Answer.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, joined once again for our concluding segment in this very special edition of Secure Freedom Radio by Ambassador Henry Cooper, the man who led our missile defense efforts under George Herbert Walker Bush, worked for President Reagan with me back in the good old days, ambassador as the defense and space talks, among other capacities, a man who now runs a terrific organization, High Frontier, and is a colleague and comrade in many of the fights that we'd find ourselves in, trying to provide for the security of the United States and promoting peace through strength. And Hank, one of the things that we sort of alluded to there, but I'd like to ask you to discuss a little bit, is what happens if we not only don't have missile defense capabilities and sensors and the like in space to protect this country, but we cede control of space to hostile powers. And in particular, I'm thinking of the Chinese, because they are making a very concerted effort, it seems, to exercise dominion over not only low Earth orbit, but in fact what they call the Earth-Moon continuum. Give us a flavor of why the high frontier matters so much and why we best not lose control of it.
Well, the high ground has always mattered. You know, go to Gettysburg sometime and look at, just the problems that were faced by Robert E. Lee going up that enormous hill. So this is it's a well-known fact of military history that high ground matters, and the ultimate high ground is space. And yes, you're right. The Chinese get it. Michael Pillsbury has been writing about their doctrine and the military writings that they've had for many years. And I just one more thing that most people may not recognize. In addition to the fact that the Chinese have infiltrated our systems and robbed our industries of technology, I have to say that while we refuse to advance the Brilliant Pebbles technology and the miniaturization that was associated with it, we know that that technology made its way by way of other organizations overseas to the Chinese. So the Chinese well understand the principles and the technology, and anybody who's ever dealt with the mind of folk from that side know that they're competent technical people. And so I have no doubt that they're going to fully exploit the potential of space. And meanwhile, we've been sitting on our hands now for the better part of 30 years because we had this political opposition, you know, no weapons in space, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. We've got to get over that, and we've got to remove the inhibitions of our technical people. In fact, during the Clinton years, they purged the entire system of the records that we had. I hope Laurel Wood has somehow managed to scavenge and keep them out at Livermore, but they dispersed the technical teams as well, and we haven't used that technology even to improve the capabilities of our ground and sea-based systems. It's really been a travesty.
It is malfeasance, I think, is the only word for it. And Hank Cooper, let me turn to one last topic with you before we have to let you go that's related to everything else we've discussed, and another area in which you've spent an awful lot of your professional life, namely trying to deter attack against this country, not only to defeat it. As you know so well, going back to the end of World War II, the period you discussed a moment ago, dropping bombs on Japan, it's really resided in our nuclear forces, our sea-based, our air-breathing, our land-based missiles and bombers and so on. And I wonder if you might give us, based on your knowledge of those systems and the time we spent together putting many of them in place during the Reagan administration, an assessment of whether they remain up to the job of deterring enemies, including the Chinese, the Russians, and others who are massively increasing their own nuclear capabilities, or whether, you know, we may be really watching the atrophying of our deterrent forces in a way that could be very problematic.
I think Reagan's peace through strength agenda was the right approach to deterrence. Many people in those times, and I fear now, are thinking that only you have to have is a few nuclear weapons, and that deters, what will the annihilation of all we hold dear. And in those days, we wondered why the Soviets kept building up these forces, and we had this attitude that you could stop. Hal Brown said, we build, they build, we stop, they build. And we finally understood what they were up to. And so Reagan had it right. We had to confront that with real force. I think we have to do that again. We're still ahead, I think, of the Chinese. Regrettably, I don't know that we have the determination to deal with the deterrent posture vis-a-vis the Soviets or the Russians these days. Strikes me that Putin knows what he's doing and we don't.
Well, and you know, even the Chinese, they've invested in 3,000 miles of underground hardened tunnels in which we believe they're squirreling away some unknown sized arsenal. And that's probably not to be underestimated.
I've actually been into some of those tunnels, and you're right. Yes, I have.
Well, let me ask you about one other thing, because this is dating both of us. But back in the Reagan administration, I remember fondly working closely with you in support of President Reagan's position that as long as we had to rely on nuclear deterrence, we needed to be sure the weapons worked properly, which involved underground nuclear testing on a regular and as needed basis. That's something we stopped doing shortly after you and I left the Pentagon and the Arms Control and Disarmament Agency and elsewhere in government. What is your current sense, Hank, as a scientist, as an engineer, as a national security practitioner, of the possibility that over the period since 1992, when we last did one of these tests, things may have happened to our deterrent that could make atrophy the least of our problems? It may catastrophically fail.
Well, I've been away from the hard data on that for some time, as you know, Frank, so I can't tell you about a current assessment. But what I can tell you as a technical person and an engineer is that I don't believe things I don't test. I mentioned earlier that the design of a nuclear weapon, a rudimentary design. Actually, our first one was not tested before it was used. However, that thing was an enormous thing. I mean, it had all sorts of contingency planning that went into it. The kinds of weapons that we put, multiple weapons on our missiles and so on, are designed in a much more fragile way. They're designed near to a cost-effective margin, so to speak. And I worry about that leading to conditions where you would have fragilities that you didn't anticipate. We've gone through, I'm sure, impressive improvements in our computing capability and our simulation capability. But in my judgment, there is no substitute for real test. And I think we should consider going back and testing some of these weapons. And we should be designing new ones, by the way, not just relying on modifying what we have.
Yeah, and that's especially true, Hank, as you know so well, when you're dealing with weapons that really have aged. There's stuff in those weapons, in some cases, that's carcinogenic or simply obsolete, and the changes being made to them without testing is also another matter of concern to me in terms of assuring their efficacy. Hank, that we've come to the end of a full, very productive hour of conversation with you. I'm sorry to say it's been both fascinating and highly informative. We expected nothing less, of course. Thank you for taking the time and for treating us to your insights on so many different topics. We'll look forward to visiting with you again in the future, hopefully in the very near future. In the meantime, keep up the great work you do at High Frontier, and thank you for your extraordinary service to our country over so many years. I hope the rest of you will join us again tomorrow for more at Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.